Banner Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram time.
It's 6 o'clock.
104.9.
Preset us on your radio.
Pickup Country.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you for joining us tonight on Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV for our new and exciting Pick Me a Story series, where you'll embark on a journey through the pages of different stories read aloud by featured librarians from the Powell County Public Library. You can tune in live right here on Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV, listen online or on demand at listenlikealocal.com with our free mobile app from the Google Play or App Store or on Apple Podcast. My name is Kelly Ward, and I am the Teen and Adult Services Librarian at the Powell County Public Library. I'll be reading all kinds of different books to you from different genres, like sci-fi and fantasy, westerns, mysteries, and more. Be healthy at home with the whole family and enjoy the storytelling service provided by Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV and the Powell County Public Library. Pick Me a Story will be every Thursday at 6 o'clock p.m. right here on your hometown station, and we're so excited you can join us tonight. Let's get started. Last week, we left off with Harlan Ellison's sci-fi short story, "Repent, Harlequin," said the TikTok man. We were introduced to a futuristic world where everything exists by strict order and strict time restraints, ordained by the all-powerful roller, the TikTok man, who has the power to turn people off when they run out of time, or by his whim, whenever he wants to. In the story so far, we've met our hero, Everett C. Marm, who is a joker, prankster, and all-around rule-breaker in this time-driven society. He dons a Harlequin mask when he's out in public causing chaos, like when he unleashed hundreds of thousands of jelly beans into the streets, disrupting time for everyone, ultimately making himself the next target for the master timekeeper, the TikTok man. What started off as a story of rebellion and anarchy seems to be devolving in the TikTok man's hands as the Harlequin nears his capture by the master timekeeper. What will become of our dimpled, charismatic Harlequin, and will his pranks start a rebellion in this time-locked society? Or will the TikTok man win again? Let's find out. The story is called "Repent, Harlequin," said the TikTok man by Harlan Ellison. After the debacle, in which, through the Harlequin's attention to personal safety, no one was seriously injured, the workers tried to reassemble and assault him again, but it was too late. He had vanished. It had attracted quite a crowd, however, and the shopping cycle was thrown off by hours, simply hours. The purchasing needs of the system were therefore falling behind, and so measures were taken to accelerate the cycle for the rest of the day. But it got bogged down and speeded up, and they sold too many float valves and not nearly enough wegglers, which meant that the Popley ratio was off, which made it necessary to rush cases and cases of spoiling smash-o to stores that usually needed a case only every 3 or 4 hours. The shipments were bollocksed, the transshipments were misrouted, and in the end, even the Swizzles Kid Industries felt it. "Don't come back till you have him," the TikTok man said, very quietly, very sincerely, extremely dangerously. They used dogs. They used probes. They used cardio plate cross-offs. They used teepers. They used bribery. They used stick tights. They used intimidation. They used torment. They used torture. They used finks. They used cops. They used search and seizure. They used Feleron. They used betterment incentive. They used fingerprints. They used Bertillon. They used cunning. They used guile. They used treachery. They used Raoul Mitgong, but he didn't help much. They used applied physics. They used techniques of criminology. And, what the heck, they caught him. After all, his name was Everett C. Marm, and he wasn't much to begin with, except a man who had no sense of time. "Repent, Harlequin," said the TikTok man. "Get stuffed," the Harlequin replied, sneering. "You've been late a total of 63 years, 5 months, 3 weeks, 2 days, 12 hours, 41 minutes, 59 seconds, 0.03611 microseconds. You've used up everything you can, and more. I'm going to turn you off." "Scare someone else. I'd rather be dead than live in a dumb world with a boogeyman like you. It's my job. You're full of it. You're a tyrant. You have no right to order people around and kill them if they show up late. You can't adjust. You can't fit in. Unstrap me and I'll fit my fist into your mouth. You're a nonconformist. That didn't used to be a felony. It is now. Live in the world around you. I hate it. It's a terrible world. Not everyone thinks so. Most people enjoy order. I don't, and most of the people I know don't. That's not true. How do you think we caught you? I'm not interested. A girl named Pretty Alice told us who you were. That's a lie. It's true. You unnerve her. She wants to belong. She wants to conform. I'm going to turn you off. Then do it already and stop arguing with me. I'm not going to turn you off. You're an idiot. Repent, Harlequin, said the TikTok man. Get stuffed. So they sent him to the Coventry, and in Coventry, they worked him over. It was just like what they did to Winston Smith in 1984, which was a book none of them knew about. But the techniques are really quite ancient, and so they did it to Everett C. Marm. And one day, quite a long time later, the Harlequin appeared on the communications web, appearing elfish and dimpled and bright-eyed and not at all brainwashed. And he said he had been wrong, that it was a very good thing indeed to belong and be right on time, hip-ho, and away we go. And everyone stared up at him on the public screens that covered an entire city block. And they said to themselves, well, you see, he was just a nut after all. And if that's the way the system is run, then let's do it that way, because it doesn't pay to fight City Hall, or in this case, the TikTok man. So, Everett C. Marm was destroyed, which was a loss because of what Thoreau said earlier. But you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs. And in every revolution, a few die who shouldn't, but they have to, because that's the way it happens. And if you make only a little change, then it seems to be worthwhile. Or, to make the point lucidly. Excuse me, sir, I don't know how to tell you this, but you are 3 minutes late. The schedule is a bit off. He grinned sheepishly. That's ridiculous, murmured the TikTok man behind his mask. Check your watch. And then he went into his office, going, Marie, 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 Marie. 1967, 25th Convention, New York. The end.
Serving Powell, Estill, Montgomery, Clark, Lee, Bath, Menifee, Owsley, and Wolf counties.
Pickup Country.
Tune in on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. right here on Pickup Country 104.9.
Online, live, or on demand at listenlikealocal.com.
With your mobile app from the Google Play or App Store or on Apple Podcasts for the Pick Your Own Adventure series, where you and you alone are in charge of what happens in the journey. Danger, choice, adventure, and consequence. Are you prepared? The wrong decision could end a disaster, or worse. Live listeners can choose your path by texting WSKV in real time to 606-663-2811. The first text will control the next choice. Text 606-663-2811 during Pick Your Own Adventure and see how your stories unfold.
Hey y'all, this is Grayson Jenkins with a message from the Powell County Office of Public Information. Until further notice, customers of Kroger, Save-A-Lot, and Superior IGA in Powell County who are under the age of 60 and do not have compromised immunity should not shop before 9 a.m. Likewise, if you are a customer over 60 years of age or have compromised immunity, you should shop from open to 9 a.m. at Powell County Kroger, Save-A-Lot, and Superior IGA. For many in our community, this will allow for a safer alternative to gathering supplies and lower the chances of compromising their health. This message is brought to you by Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV.
This next story is still in the science fiction genre, and it's another robot story by Isaac Asimov. You might remember me reading an Asimov story a few weeks ago called Robbie, which was a story about a young girl and her robot nursemaid, and dear friend named Robbie. Whereas in Robbie, the robot was physically made of metal and didn't resemble a human. In this story, we're introduced to Tony, a handsome robot who looks startling like a human. In this story, you'll meet Claire Belmont, a mousy housewife with insecurity issues, and a hopeless habit of comparing herself to her beautiful, perfect neighbor, Gladys Clefern. Tony, a robot, is stationed at Claire's home while her husband is away for experimental purposes. But Claire soon finds herself drawn closer to the alluring robot, Tony, while simultaneously being horrified with herself for forgetting he is a machine. Is it a love story or a tale about science? You can decide. The story is called Satisfaction Guaranteed, first published in 1951 by Isaac Asimov. Tony was tall and darkly handsome, with an incredibly patrician air drawn into every line of his unchangeable expression. And Clara Belmont regarded him through the crack in the door with a mixture of horror and dismay. "I can't, Larry. I just can't have him in the house." Feverishly, she was searching her paralyzed mind for a stronger way of putting it, some way that would make sense and settle things, but she could only end with a simple repetition. "Well, I can't." Larry Belmont regarded his wife stiffly, and there was that spark of impatience in his eyes that Claire hated to see, since she felt her own incompetence mirrored in it. "We're committed, Claire," he said, "and I can't have you backing out now. The company is sending me to Washington on this basis, and it probably means a promotion. It's perfectly safe, and you know it. What's your objection?" She frowned helplessly. "It just gives me the chills. I couldn't bear him." "He's as human as you or I, almost. So, no nonsense. Come, get out there." His hand was on the small of her back, shoving, and she found herself in her own living room, shivering. It was there, looking at her with a precise politeness, as though appraising his hostess-to-be of the next 3 weeks. Dr. Susan Calvin was there, too, sitting stiffly in thin-lipped abstraction. She had the cold, faraway look of someone who has worked with machines so long that a little of the steel had entered the blood. "Hello," crackled Claire in general, an ineffectual greeting. But Larry was busily saving the situation with a spurious gaiety. "Here, Claire, I want you to meet Tony, a swell guy. This is my wife, Claire, Tony, old boy." Larry's hand draped itself amiably over Tony's shoulder, but Tony remained unresponsive and expressionless under the pressure. He said, "How do you do, Mrs. Belmont?" And Claire jumped at Tony's voice. It was deep and mellow, smooth as the hair on his head or the skin on his face. Before she could stop herself, she said, "Oh my, you talk." "Why not? Did you expect that I didn't?" But Claire could only smile weakly. She didn't really know what she had expected. She looked away, then let him slide gently into the corner of her eye. His hair was smooth and black, like polished plastic. Or was it really composed of separate hairs? And was the even, olive skin of his hands and face continued on past the obscurement of his formally cut clothing? She was lost in the shuddering wonder of it, and had to force her thoughts back into place to meet Dr. Calvin's flat, unemotional voice. "Mrs. Belmont, I hope you appreciate the importance of this experiment. Your husband tells me he has given you some of the background. I would like to give you more, as the senior psychologist of the U.S. Robots and Mechanical Men Corporation. Tony is a robot. His actual designation on the company files is TN3, but he will answer to Tony. He is not a mechanical monster, nor simply a calculating machine of the type that were developed during World War II 50 years ago. He has an artificial brain nearly as complicated as our own. It is an immense telephone switchboard on an atomic scale, so that billions of possible telephone connections can be compressed into an instrument that will fit inside a skull. Such brains are manufactured for each model of robot specifically. Each contains a pre-calculated set of connections so that each robot knows the English language to start with and enough of anything else that may be necessary to perform his job. Until now, U.S. Robots has confined its manufacturing activity to industrial models for use in places where human labor is impractical, in deep mines, for instance, or in underwater work. But we want to invade the city and the home. To do so, we must get the ordinary man and woman to accept these robots without fear. You understand that there is nothing to fear. There isn't, Claire, interposed Larry earnestly. Take my word for it. It's impossible for him to do any harm. You know I wouldn't leave him without you otherwise. Claire cast a quick, secret glance at Tony and lowered her voice. What if I make him angry? You needn't whisper, said Dr. Calvin calmly. He can't get angry with you, my dear. I told you that the switchboard connections of his brain were predetermined. Well, the most important connection of all is what we call the first law of robotics, and it is merely this. No robot can harm a human being, or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. All robots are built so. No robot can be forced in any way to do harm to any human. So, you see, we need you and Tony as a preliminary experiment for our own guidance, while your husband is in Washington to arrange for government-supervised legal tests. You mean all this isn't legal? Larry cleared his throat. Not just yet, but it's all right. He won't leave the house, and you mustn't let anyone see him. That's all. And, Claire, I'd stay with you, but I know too much about the robots. We must have a completely inexperienced tester so that we can have severe conditions. It's necessary. Oh, well, muttered Claire. Then, as a thought struck her, but what does he do? Housework, said Dr. Calvin shortly. She got up to leave, and it was Larry who saw her to the front door. Claire stayed behind drearily. She caught a glimpse of herself in the mirror above the mantelpiece and looked away hastily. She was very tired of her small, mousy face and her dim, unimaginative hair. Then she caught Tony's eyes upon her and almost smiled before she remembered. He was only a machine. Larry Belmont was on his way to the airport when he caught a glimpse of Gladys Clefern. She was the type of woman who seemed made to be seen in glimpses. Perfectly and precisely manufactured, dressed with thoughtful hand and eye, too gleaming to be stared at. The little smile that preceded her and the faint scent that trailed her were a pair of beckoning fingers. Larry felt his stride break. He touched his hat, then hurried on. As always, he felt that vague anger. If Claire could only push her way into the Clefern clique, it would help so much. But what was the use? Claire. The few times she had come face to face with Gladys, the little fool had been tongue-tied. He had no illusions. The testing of Tony was his big chance, and it was in Claire's hands. How much safer it would be in the hands of someone like Gladys Clefern. Claire woke the second morning to the sound of a subdued knock on the bedroom door. Her mind clamored, then went icy. She had avoided Tony the first day, smiling thinly when she met him and brushing past with a wordless sound of apology. Is that you, Tony? Yes, Mrs. Belmont. May I enter? She must have said yes, because he was in the room, quite suddenly and noiselessly. Her eyes and nose were simultaneously aware of the tray he was carrying. Breakfast? She said. If you please. She wouldn't have dared to refuse, so she pushed herself slowly into a sitting position and received it. Poached eggs, buttered toast, coffee. I have brought the sugar and cream separately, said Tony. I expect to learn your preference with time, in this and in other things. She waited. Tony, standing there straight and pliant as a metal roll, asked, after a moment, Would you prefer to eat in privacy? Yes, I mean, if you don't mind. Will you need help later in dressing? Oh my, no! She clutched frantically at the sheet so that the coffee hovered at the edge of catastrophe. She remained so, in rigor, then sank helplessly back against the pillow when the door closed him out of her sight again. She got through breakfast somehow. He was only a machine, and if it were only more visible that he were, it wouldn't be so frightening. Or if his expression would change. It just stayed there, nailed on. You couldn't tell what went on behind those dark eyes and that smooth olive skin stuff. The coffee cup beat a faint castanet for a moment as she set it back, empty, on the tray. Then, she realized that she had forgotten to add the sugar and cream after all, and she did so hate black coffee. She burned a straight path from bedroom to kitchen after dressing. It was her house, after all, and there wasn't anything frippy about her. But she liked her kitchen clean. He should have waited for supervision. But when she entered, she found a kitchen that might have been minted fire new from the factory the moment before. She stopped, stared, turned on her heel, and nearly ran into Tony. She yelped. "May I help?" he asked. "Tony!" and she scraped the anger off the edges of her mind's panic. "You must make some noise when you walk. I can't have you stalking me, you know. Didn't you use this kitchen?"
"I did, Mrs. Belmont."
"It doesn't look it. I cleaned up afterward. Isn't that customary?" Claire opened her eyes wide. After all, what could one say to that? She opened the oven compartment that held the pots, took a quick, unseeing look at the metallic glitter inside, then said with a tremor, "Very good, quite satisfactory." If at the moment he had beamed, if he had smiled, if he had quirked the corner of his mouth the slightest bit, she felt that she could have warmed to him. But he remained an English lord in repose as he said, "Thank you, Mrs. Belmont. Would you come into the living room?" She did, and it struck her at once. "Have you been polishing the furniture?" "Is it satisfactory, Mrs. Belmont?"
"But when? You didn't do it yesterday."
"Last night, of course."
"You burned the lights all night?"
"Oh no, that wouldn't have been necessary. I've a built-in ultraviolet source. I can see in ultraviolet. And, of course, I don't require sleep." He did require admiration, though. She realized that, then. He had to know that he was pleasing her. But she couldn't bring herself to supply that pleasure for him. She could only say sourly, "Your kind will put ordinary houseworkers out of business." There is work of much greater importance than can be put to work in the world once they are freed of drudgery. After all, Mrs. Belmont, things like myself can be manufactured, but nothing yet can imitate the creativity and versatility of a human brain, like yours. And though his face gave no hint, his voice was warmly surcharged with awe and admiration, so that Claire flushed and muttered, "My brain? You can have it." Tony approached a little and said, "You must be unhappy to say such a thing. Is there anything I can do?" For a moment, Claire felt like laughing. It was a ridiculous situation. Here was an animated carpet sweeper, dishwasher, furniture polisher, general factotum, rising from the factory table, and offering his services as consoler and confidant. Yet, she said suddenly, in a burst of woe and voice, "Mr. Belmont doesn't think I have a brain, if you must know. And I suppose I haven't." She couldn't cry in front of him. She felt, for some reason, that she had the honor of the human race to support against this mere creation. "It's lately," she added. "It was all right when he was a student, when he was just starting. But I can't be a big man's wife, and he's getting to be a big man. He wants me to be a hostess and an entry into social life for him, like Gladys Claffern." Her nose was red, and she looked away. But Tony wasn't watching her. His eyes wandered about the room. "I can help you run the house." "But it's no good," she said fiercely. "It needs a touch I can't give it. I can only make it comfortable. I can't ever make it the kind they take pictures of for the Home Beautiful magazines." "Do you want that kind?" "Does it do any good, wanting?" Tony's eyes were on her. Full. "I could help." "Do you know anything about interior decoration?"
"Is this something a good housekeeper should know?"
"Oh, yes."
"Then I have the potentialities of learning it. Can you get me books on the subject?"
Something started then. And we'll be back with more right after this.
We hope you get stuck on Pickup Country. 104.9 WSKV.
This message is brought to you by the Powell County Public Library. Although closed until further notice, the library staff are hard at work still providing innovative community programs for all ages. Like the Powell County Public Library's official Facebook page, where you can stay up to date with all library-related news, programs, and events. All checkout dates have been extended through the end of April, and all checked out materials should be kept home for the time being. With the library being closed, there will be no curbside service, no printing services, and no bookmobile service at this time. But you can still check out their online catalog by going to their website at pcplky.org to see everything their digital collection has to offer. For any questions, just send a message to the official Powell County Public Library Facebook page, and one of the available librarians will get in touch with you as soon as possible. The staff of the Powell County Public Library encourage you to stay healthy at home and practice social distancing methods to be a part of hashtag Team Kentucky and hashtag TogetherKY.
Hey, this is Hannah Wheeler. You can help stop the spread of germs by staying home when you are sick, except to get required medical care. They suggest, if you are worried well, stay home. If you're ill, but would not have gone to the doctor before the COVID-19 outbreak, just call for advice. And if you are sick and feel like you have an emergency, seek immediate care. This message is brought to you by Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV.
Claire, clutching her hat against the brawling liberties of the wind, had manipulated two fat volumes on the home arts back from the public library. She watched Tony as he opened one of them and flipped the pages. It was the first time she had watched his fingers flicker at anything like fine work. "I don't see how they do it," she thought, and on a sudden impulse, reached for his hand and pulled it toward herself. Tony did not resist, but let it lie limp for inspection. She said, "It's remarkable. Even your fingernails look natural." "That's deliberate, of course," said Tony. Then, chattily, "The skin is a flexible plastic, and the skeletal framework is a light metal alloy. Does that amuse you?" "Oh, no." She lifted her reddened face. "I just feel a little embarrassed at sort of poking into your insides. It's none of my business. You don't ask me about mine." "My brain paths don't include that type of curiosity. I can only act within my limitations, you know?" And Claire felt something tighten inside her in the silence that followed. Why did she keep forgetting he was a machine? Now the thing itself had to remind her. Was she so starved for sympathy that she would even accept a robot as equal because he sympathized? She noticed Tony was still flipping the pages, almost helplessly, and there was a quick, shooting sense of relieved superiority within her. "You can't read, can you?" Tony looked up at her, his voice calm, unreproachful. "I am reading, Mrs. Belmont." "But..." She pointed at the book in a meaningless gesture. "I am scanning the pages, if that's what you mean. My sense of reading is photographic." It was evening then, and when Claire eventually went to bed, Tony was well into the second volume, sitting there in the dark, or what seemed dark to Claire's limited eyes. Her last thought, the one that clamored at her just as her mind let go and tumbled, was a queer one. She remembered his hand again, the touch of it. It had been warm and soft, like a human being's. "How clever of the factory," she thought, and softly ebbed to sleep. It was the library continuously, thereafter, for several days. Tony suggested the fields of study, which branched out quickly. There were books on color matching and on cosmetics, on carpentry, on fashions, on art, and on the history of costumes. He turned the pages of each book before his solemn eyes, and, as quickly as he turned, he read. Nor did he seem capable of forgetting. Before the end of the week, he had insisted on cutting her hair, introducing her to a new method of arranging it, adjusting her eyebrow line a bit, and changing the shade of her powder and lipstick. She had palpitated in nervous dread for half an hour under the delicate touch of his inhuman fingers, and then looked in the mirror. "There is more that can be done," said Tony, "especially in clothes. How do you find it for a beginning?" And she hadn't answered, not for quite a while. Not until she had absorbed the identity of the stranger in the glass and cooled the wonder at the beauty of it all. Then she had said chokingly, never once taking her eyes from the warming image, "Yes, Tony, quite good. For a beginning."
She said nothing of this in her letters to Larry. Let him see it all at once. And something in her realized that it wasn't only the surprise she would enjoy. It was going to be a kind of revenge. Tony said one morning, "It's time to start buying, and I'm not allowed to leave the house. If I write out exactly what we must have, can I trust you to get it? We need drapery and furniture fabric, wallpaper, carpeting, paint, clothing, and any number of small things. You can't get these things to your own specifications at a stroke's notice," said Claire doubtfully. "You can get fairly close if you go through the city and if money is no object." "But Tony, money is certainly an object." "Not at all. Stop off at U.S. Robots in the first place. I'll write a note for you. You see Dr. Calvin and tell her that I said it was part of the experiment." Dr. Calvin, somehow, didn't frighten her as on that first evening. With her new face and a new hat, she couldn't be quite the old Claire. The psychologist listened carefully, asked a few questions, nodded, and then Claire found herself walking out, armed with an unlimited charge account against the assets of U.S. Robots and Mechanical Men Corporation. It is wonderful what money will do. With a store's contents at her feet, a saleslady dictum was not necessarily a voice from above. The uplifted eyebrow of a decorator was not anything like Jove's thunder. And once, when an exalted plumpness at one of the most lordly of the garment salons had insistently pooed her description of the wardrobe, she must have, with counter-pronouncements and accents of the purest 57th Street French, she called up Tony, then held the phone out to Monsieur. "If you don't mind," voice firm, but fingers twisting a bit, "I'd like you to talk to my, secretary." Pudgy proceeded to the phone with a solemn arm crooked behind his back. He lifted the phone in two fingers and said delicately, "Yes." A short pause. Another, "Yes." Then, a much longer pause. A squeaky beginning of an objection that perished quickly. Another pause. A very meek, "Yes." And the phone was restored to its cradle. "If Madame will come with me," he said, hurt in distance, "I will try to supply her needs." "Just a second." Claire rushed back to the phone and dialed again. "Hello, Tony? I don't know what you said, but it worked. Thanks. You're a..." She struggled for the appropriate word, gave up, and ended in a final little squeak. A dear." It was Gladys Clefern looking at her when she turned from the phone again. A slightly amused and slightly amazed Gladys Clefern looking at her out of a face tilted a bit to one side. "Mrs. Belmont?" It all drained out of Claire, just like that. She could only nod, stupidly, like a marionette. Gladys smiled with an insolence you couldn't put your finger on. "I didn't know you shopped here." As if the place had, in her eyes, definitely lost caste through the fact. "I don't, usually," said Claire humbly. "And haven't you done something to your hair? It's quite quaint. Oh, I hope you'll excuse me, but isn't your husband's name Lawrence? It seems to me that it's Lawrence." Claire's teeth clenched, but she had to explain. She had to. "Tony is a friend of my husband's. He's helping me select some things." "I understand, and quite a dear about it, I imagine." She passed on, smiling, carrying the light and the warmth of the world with her. Claire did not question the fact that it was to Tony that she turned for consolation. 10 days had cured her of reluctance, and she could weep before him, weep and rage. "I was a complete fool," she stormed, wrenching at her waterlogged handkerchief. "She does that to me. I don't know why. She just does. I should have kicked her. I should have knocked her down and stamped on her." "Can you hate a human being so much?" asked Tony in puzzled softness. "That part of a human mind is closed to me." "Oh, it isn't she," she moaned. "It's myself, I suppose. She's everything I want to be. On the outside, anyway. And I can't be." Tony's voice was forceful and low in her ear. You can be, Mrs. Belmont. You can be. We have 10 days yet, and in 10 days the house will no longer be itself. Haven't we been planning that? And how will that help me with her? Invite her here. Invite her friends. Have it the evening before I leave. It will be a housewarming, in a way. She won't come. Yes, she will. She'll come to laugh, and she won't be able to. Do you really think so? Oh, Tony, do you think we can do it? She had both his hands in hers, and then, with her face flung aside, but what good would it be? It won't be I. It will be you that's doing it. I can't ride your back. Nobody lives in splendid singleness, whispered Tony. They've put that knowledge in me. What you or anyone see in Gladys Clefern is not just Gladys Clefern. She rides the back of all that money and social position can bring. She doesn't question that. Why should you? And look at it this way, Mrs. Belmont. I am manufactured to obey, but the extent of my obedience is for myself to determine. I can follow orders negatively or liberally. For you, it is liberal, because you are what I have been manufactured to see human beings as. You are kind, friendly, unassuming. Mrs. Clefern, as you describe her, is not, and I wouldn't obey her as I would you. So it is you, and not I, Mrs. Belmont, that is doing all this. He withdrew his hands from hers then, and Clara looked at that expressionless face no one could read, wondering. She was suddenly frightened again, in a completely new way. She swallowed nervously and stared at her hands, which were still tingling with the pressure of his fingers. She hadn't imagined it. His fingers had pressed hers, gently, tenderly, just before they moved away. No! Its fingers. Its fingers. She ran to the bathroom and scrubbed her hands, blindly, uselessly. She was a bit shy of him the next day, watching him narrowly, waiting to see what might follow, and for a while, nothing did. Tony was working. If there was any difficulty in technique in putting up wallpaper or utilizing the quick-drying paint, Tony's activity did not show it. His hands moved precisely. His fingers were deft and sure. He worked all night. She never heard him, but each morning was a new adventure. She couldn't count the number of times that had been done, and by evening, she was still finding new touches. And another night had come. She tried to help only once, and her human clumsiness marred that. He was in the next room, and she was hanging a picture in the spot marked by Tony's mathematical eyes. The little mark was there, the picture was there, and a revulsion against idleness was there. But she was nervous. Or the latter was rickety. It didn't matter. She felt it going, and she cried out. It tumbled without her, for Tony, with far more than flesh and blood quickness, had been under her. His calm, dark eyes said nothing at all, and his warm voice said only words. Are you hurt, Mrs. Belmont? She noticed for an instant that her falling hand must have mussed that sleek hair of his, because for the first time, she could see for herself that it was composed of distinct strands, fine black hairs. And then, all at once, she was conscious of his arms about her shoulders and under her knees, holding her tightly and warmly. She pushed, and her scream was loud in her own ears. She spent the rest of the day in her room, and thereafter, she slept with a chair appended against the doorknob of her bedroom door. She had sent out the invitations, and, as Tony had said, they were accepted. She had only to wait for the last evening. It came, too, after the rest of them, in its proper place. The house was scarcely her own. She went through it one last time, and every room had changed. She, herself, was in clothes she would never have dared wear before. And when you put them on, you put on pride and confidence with them. She tried a polite look of contemptuous amusement before the mirror, and the mirror sneered back at her masterfully. What would Larry say? It didn't matter, somehow. The exciting days weren't coming with him. They were leaving with Tony. Now, wasn't that strange? She tried to recapture her mood of 3 weeks before and failed completely. The clock shrieked 8 at her in 8 breathless installments, and she turned to Tony. "They'll be here soon, Tony. You'd better get into the basement. We can't let them..." She stared a moment, then said weakly, "Tony?" And more strongly, "Tony?" And nearly a scream, "Tony!" But his arms were around her now. His face was close to hers. The pressure of his embrace was relentless. She heard his voice through a haze of emotional jumble. "Claire," the voice said, "there are many things I am not made to understand, and this must be one of them. I am leaving tomorrow, and I don't want to. I find that there is more in me than just a desire to please you. Isn't it strange?" His face was closer. His lips were warm, but with no breath behind them, for machines do not breathe. They were almost on hers. And the bell sounded. For a moment, she struggled breathlessly, and then he was gone, and nowhere in sight, and the bell was sounding again. Its intermittent shrillness was insistent. The curtains on the front windows had been pulled open. They had been closed 15 minutes earlier. She knew that. They must have seen then. They must all have seen everything. They came in so politely, all in a bunch. The pack came to howl, with their sharp, darting eyes piercing everywhere. They had seen. Why else would Gladys ask in her jabbingness manner after Larry? And Claire was spurred to a desperate and reckless defiance. "Yes, he is away. He'll be back tomorrow, I suppose. No, I haven't been lonely here myself. Not a bit. I've had an exciting time." And she laughed at them. Why not? What could they do? Larry would know the truth, if it ever came to him. The story of what they thought they saw. But they didn't laugh. She could read that in the fury in Gladys Clefern's eyes, in the false sparkle of her words, in her desire to leave early. And as she parted with them, she caught one last anonymous whisper, disjointed. "Never saw anything like so handsome." And she knew what it was that had enabled her to finger snap them so. Let each cat mew, and let each cat know that she might be prettier than Claire Belmont, and grander, and richer. But not one could have so handsome a lover. And then she remembered again, that Tony was a machine, and her skin crawled. "Go away! Leave me be!" She cried to the empty room and ran to her bed. She wept wakefully all that night, and the next morning, almost before dawn, when the streets were empty, a car drew up to the house and took Tony away. Lawrence Belmont passed Dr. Calvin's office and, on impulse, knocked. He found her with mathematician Peter Bogart, but did not hesitate on that account. He said, "Claire tells me that you as robots paid for all that was done at my house." "Yes," said Dr. Calvin. "We've written it off as a valuable and necessary part of the experiment. With your new position as associate engineer, you'll be able to keep it up, I think." "That's not what I'm worried about. With Washington agreeing to the test, we'll be able to get a TN model of our own by next year, I think." He turned hesitantly, as though to go, and as hesitantly turned back again. "Well, Mr. Belmont?" asked Dr. Calvin, after a pause. "I wonder," began Larry. "I wonder what really happened there. Claire, seems so different. It's not just her looks, though, frankly, I'm amazed." He laughed nervously. "It's her. She's not my wife, really. I can't explain it." "Why try? Are you disappointed with any part of the change?" "On the contrary. But it's a little frightening, too, you see." "I wouldn't worry, Mr. Belmont. Your wife has handled herself very well. Frankly, I never expected to have the experiment yield such a thorough and complete test. We know exactly what corrections must be made in the TN model, and the credit belongs entirely to Mrs. Belmont. If you want me to be very honest, I think your wife deserves your promotion more than you do." Larry flinched visibly at that. "As long as it's in the family," he murmured unconvincingly and left. Susan Calvin looked after him. "I think that hurt. I hope. Have you read Tony's report, Peter?" "Thoroughly,"
said Bogert. And won't the TN3 model need changes? Oh, you think so too? Questioned Calvin sharply. What's your reasoning? Bogert frowned. I don't need any. It's obvious on the face of it that we can't have a robot loose, which is in love with its mistress, if you don't mind the pun. Love? Peter, you sicken me. You really don't understand? That machine had to obey the first law. He couldn't allow harm to come to a human being, and harm was coming to Claire Belmont through her own sense of inadequacy. So he made her think that he loved her, since what woman would fail to appreciate the compliment of being able to stir passion in a machine? In a cold, soulless machine. And he opened the curtains that night deliberately, that the others might see and envy, without any risk possible to Claire's marriage. I think it was clever of Tony. Do you? What's the difference whether it was pretense or not, Susan? It still has its horrifying effect. Read the report again. She avoided him. She screamed when he held her. She didn't sleep that last night, in hysterics. We can't have that. Peter, you're blind. You're as blind as I was. The TN model will be rebuilt entirely, but not for your reason. Quite otherwise. Quite otherwise. Strange that I overlooked it in the first place. Her eyes were opaquely thoughtful. But perhaps it reflects a shortcoming in myself. You see, Peter, machines can't fall in love, but even when it's hopeless and horrifying, women can. The end.
You're listening to WSKV, Pickup Country.
Tune in on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. right here on Pickup Country 104.9.
Online, live, or on demand at listenlikealocal.com.
With your mobile app from the Google Play or App Store, or on Apple Podcasts for the Pick Your Own Adventure series, where you and you alone are in charge of what happens in the journey. Danger, choice, adventure, and consequence. Are you prepared? The wrong decision could end a disaster, or worse. Live listeners can choose your path by texting WSKV in real time to 606-663-2811. The first text will control the next choice. Text 606-663-2811 during Pick Your Own Adventure and see how your stories unfold.
Hey, this is Sam L. Smith. You can stop the spread of respiratory disease like COVID-19 by covering your cough or sneeze with a tissue. Throwing away that tissue in the trash, then wash your hands with soap for 20 seconds, or using 60% or greater alcohol hand sanitizer. This message is brought to you by Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV.
You're listening to WSKV Pickup Country.
This message is brought to you by the Powell County Public Library. Free Wi-Fi is still offered at the Powell County Public Library, which is located at 725 Breckenridge Street here in Stanton. To access this Wi-Fi from the comfort of your vehicle, just select the network Public Library Wireless and use the free Wi-Fi password PCPLKY65. Free Wi-Fi is also provided at the Stationary Bookmobile, which is in the front parking lot of the Clay City First Church of God, located on Main Street in Clay City. To take advantage of the Bookmobile Wi-Fi, just sign in onto the network Bookmobile Wireless and use the same password from the main library, which is PCPLKY65. Flyers containing all this information are posted on the doors of the main library and on the Bookmobile for reference. And you can check out digital library books, audiobooks, and magazines with the free Libby or OverDrive apps in the Google Play or App Store. All you need is the barcode number on the back of your library card to have access to thousands of e-books and digital materials. The staff of the Powell County Public Library encourage you to stay healthy at home and practice social distancing methods to be part of hashtag Team Kentucky and hashtag Together Kentucky.
Hey, this is Anna Klein.
And John Looney.
We're Grits and Soul. The Kentucky Department of Health and Family Services advises all working people to work from home and all students in schools to use distance learning options.
We encourage you to stay at home if you're sick or show any symptoms that could possibly spread to others.
Please stay well and stay healthy at home.
This message is brought to you by Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV.
This next story we're going to get started with is also by Isaac Asimov and features his classic character, the one and only robo-psychologist Susan Calvin, who was in the previous story. In this story, something goes wrong in the production of a mining model LNE robot, giving it the disturbing characteristic of that of a human child. Susan Calvin tries to crack the case of the broken robot, but
The stern, unfeeling scientist begins to feel a softness for the robot. Something akin to motherhood. This story is called Lenny by Isaac Asimov. United States Robots and Mechanical Men Corporation had a problem. The problem was people. Peter Bogert, senior mathematician, was on his way to assembly when he encountered Alfred Lanning, research director. Lanning was bending his ferocious white eyebrows together and staring down across the railing into the computer room. On the floor below the balcony, a trickle of humanity of both sexes and various ages was looking about curiously, while a guide intoned a set speech about robotic computing. "This computer you see before you," he said, "is the largest of its type in the world. It contains 5,300,000 cryotrons, and is capable of dealing simultaneously with over 100,000 variables. With its help, you as robots is able to design with precision the positronic brains of new models. The requirements are fed in on tape, which is perforated by the action of this keyboard. Something like a very complicated typewriter or linotype machine, except that it does not deal with letters, but with concepts. Statements are broken down into the symbolic logic equivalents, and those in turn converted to perforation patterns. The computer can, in less than 1 hour, present our scientists with a design for a brain which will give all the necessary positronic paths to make a robot." Alfred Lanning looked up at last and noticed the other. "Ah, Peter," he said. Bogert raised both his hands to smooth down his already perfect, smooth and glossy head of black hair. He said, "You don't look as though you think much of this, Alfred." Lanning grunted. The idea of public guided tours of U.S. robots was of fairly recent origin and was supposed to serve a dual function. On the one hand, the theory went, it allowed people to see robots at close quarters and counter their almost instinctive fear of the mechanical objects through increased familiarity. And on the other hand, it was supposed to interest at least an occasional person in taking up robotics research as a life work. "You know I don't," Lanning said finally. "Once a week, work is disrupted. Considering the man-hours lost, the return is insufficient." "Still no rise in job applications, then?" "Oh, some, but only in the categories where the need isn't vital. It's research men that are needed. You know that. The trouble is that, with robots forbidden on Earth itself, there's something unpopular about being a roboticist." "The darn Frankenstein complex," said Bogert, consciously imitating one of the other's pet phrases. Lanning missed the gentle jab. He said, "I ought to be used to it, but I never will. You'd think that by now every human being on Earth would know that the three laws represented a perfect safeguard, that robots are simply not dangerous. Take this bunch," he glowered down. "Look at them. Most of them go through the robot assembly room for the thrill of fear, like riding a roller coaster. Then, when they enter the room with the MEC model, Peter, a MEC model that will do nothing on God's green earth but take two steps forward, say, 'Pleased to meet you, sir,' shake hands, then take two steps back, they back away and mothers snatch up their kids. How do we expect to get brain work out of such idiots?" Bogert had no answer. Together, they stared down once again at the line of sightseers, now passing out of the computer room and into the positronic brain assembly section. Then they left. They did not, as it turned out, observe Mortimer W. Jacobson, age 16, who, to do him complete justice, meant no harm whatever. In fact, it cannot even be said to be Mortimer's fault. The day of the week on which the tour took place was known to all workers. All devices in its path ought to have been carefully neutralized or locked, since it was unreasonable to expect human beings to withstand the temptation to handle knobs, keys, handles, and push buttons. In addition, the guide ought to have been very carefully on the watch for those who succumbed. But, at the time, the guide had passed into the next room, and Mortimer was tailing the line. He passed the keyboard on which instructions were fed into the computer. He had no way of suspecting that the plans for a new robot design were being fed into it at that moment. Or, being a good kid, he would have avoided the keyboard. He had no way of knowing that, by what amounted to almost criminal negligence, a technician had not inactivated the keyboard. So, Mortimer touched the keys at random, as though he were playing a musical instrument. He did not notice that a section of perforated tape stretched itself out of the instrument in another part of the room, soundlessly, unobtrusively. Nor did the technician, when he returned, discover any signs of tampering. He felt a little uneasy at noticing that the keyboard was live, but did not think to check. After a few minutes, even his first trifling uneasiness was gone, and he continued feeding data into the computer. As for Mortimer, neither then nor ever afterward did he know what he had done. The new LNE model was designed for the mining of boron in the asteroid belt. The boron hydrides were increasing in value yearly as primers for the proton micropiles that carry the ultimate load of power production on spaceships, and Earth's own meager supply was running thin. Physically, that meant the LNE robots would have to be equipped with eyes sensitive to those lines prominent in the spectroscopic analysis of boron ores, and the types of limbs most useful for the working up of ore to finished product. As always, though, the mental equipment was the major problem. The first LNE positronic brain had been completed now. It was the prototype and would join all other prototypes in U.S. Robots' collection. When finally tested, others would then be manufactured for leasing, never selling, to mining corporations. LNE prototype was complete now. Tall, straight, polished, it looked from outside like any of a number of not-too-specialized robot models. The technician in charge, guided by the directions for testing in the Handbook of Robotics, said, "How are you?" The indicated answer was to have been, "I am well and ready to begin my functions. I trust you are well, too," or some trivial modification thereof. This first exchange served no purpose but to show that the robot could hear, understand a routine question, and make a routine reply congruent with what one would expect of a robotic attitude. Beginning from there, one could pass on to more complicated matters that would test the different laws and their interaction with the specialized knowledge of each particular model. So, the technician said, "How are you?" He was instantly jolted by the nature of LNE prototype's voice. It had a quality like no robotic voice he had ever heard, and he had heard many. It formed syllables like the chimes of a low-pitched celeste. So surprising was this that it was only after several moments that the technician heard, in retrospect, the syllables that had been formed by those heavenly tones. They were, "Da-da-da-goo?" The robot still stood tall and straight, but his right hand crept upward and a finger went into its mouth. The technician stared in absolute horror and bolted. He locked the door behind him and, from another room, put in an emergency call to Dr. Susan Calvin. And with that, we'll finish the story next Thursday night. Thank you so much for joining us tonight for our Pick Me a Story series, right here on your hometown station, Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV. If you missed tonight's segment, you can always listen on demand at listenlikealocal.com with your mobile app from the Google Play or App Store and on Apple Podcast. If you enjoyed tonight's show, be sure to tune in next Thursday at 6 o'clock p.m. right here on Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV and join me for the next installment of Pick Me a Story. My name is Kelly Ward and I'm the Teen and Adult Services Librarian at the Powell County Public Library, and it's my pleasure to share stories with the community during this time when we should all be staying healthy at home and practicing social distancing methods. If you have any recommendations for what books we should explore next, just send me an email at kward@pcplky.org. That's kward@pcplky.org. Don't forget to tune in next week on Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV, online at listenlikealocal.com, or with the free WSKV app for our next installment of Pick Me a Story. Be safe and have a wonderful rest of your evening.
FM 104.9 WSKV.